to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kruk. Each week, we explore different aspects of the world of music, including concert reviews, album reviews, and this week in music history, which is what we are bringing you today. And along with me to help me out with this program is, of course, the one and only Greg Harvey.
Ahoy, ahoy.
And the also one and only Jacob Grum.
Sitting here wondering if a matchbox will hold my clothes.
Wow. Is that one of those things that I ascribe deepness to that I shouldn't, or is it? No, it's deep. That's real
we'll
deep.
We'll have to find. I think okay. That's like part of 20 questions. Like, is it bigger than a bread box?
Will it fit in a cardboard box from IKEA?
Those are really small.
Yes, it will.
Tiny.
So, if you want to help out our program, because you've been just blown away by the first minute of content that we have produced for you, please do so by going to our website at followthesoundpodcast.com and click on the Amazon banner on the right-hand side. You can purchase all sorts of things from Amazon. It's an amazing company. It's actually responsible for 70% of the growth in the third quarter of the U.S. economic growth in e-commerce, and that, you know, is a big deal. Because that's what Amazon does.
It's also a big deal because 70% of that growth, and yet you guys aren't clicking through our darn banner.
Exactly. We're responsible for like 0.0000001% of that. We want to do more than that. So please help us out. Go to the website, followthesoundpodcast.com, and click on that Amazon banner. Do all your normal shopping, and it will not cost you anything else, but we get a little bit of money back for everything that you purchase. And... or you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. It's very simple. Also want to thank lineupmedia.fm for allowing us to do the program. You can go to lineupmedia.fm and find tons of great podcasts out there. And I am sure that you will be entertained by something else if you enjoy our program. So just go there, find whatever you want. And I want to say, if you want to find us on social media, you can go to our group, which is called Follow the Sound. It's very simple. Go there and you can interact with us. You can post things or share things, put videos on of things that you're listening to and work out just different conversations in music. If you want to start a conversation, we will gladly interact with anything that you do because, I mean, I don't really have much else to do. I'm sitting there most of the day. So I'll gladly have discussions with you. If you want to debate me, that'd be even better because then we can really get into something serious. But it's just a great community for us to get together and discuss our one mutual love, which is music. I mean, I know for a fact that the three of us in this very room have very different views on a lot of different things. But even in music, we have different views. But the one thing we all love is music.
I disagree.
Exactly, Greg. I knew you would agree with me wholeheartedly. So... let's get on to this week in music history. I'm excited. This is going to be a very good week. We are going from February 19th through February 23rd. 5 days of great musical history and birthdays. And we are starting this one out with basically what started everything.
Yeah.
Right?
Kind of.
February 19th. 1878, Thomas Edison patents the phonograph.
Yeah, that man was an inventing machine.
Yes, he was also a horrible human being. But that's beside the point because he gave us this.
Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow, and everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
Shit! Oh, shit, I love...
Yeah, it's got a good beat to it.
No, it's creepy.
The first rap album to ever drop.
Mary had a little lamb. Dude, yeah. Can you scratch the phonograph?
You probably could because of the rotating cylinder. You just have to like slide it back and forth. I mean, I'm sure it would work.
Yeah, he should have invented that.
So.
Missed opportunity, Edison.
I know we've talked about this on the show probably a year ago. But Edison, for all of his faults and all of his problems that he had in his life and with other people, did this one thing where he invents the phonograph. He invents a way to actually record sound and not only record it, but play it back, which is a very big deal. He then goes on to start the phonograph company where people can pay money to listen to music via a jukebox, essentially. And on top of that, you could then go out and buy your favorite songs and all of that kind of stuff and put them on there. Now, it had its problems. The wax cylinders could get misshapen very easily and could melt very easily. And, you know, it wasn't exactly a great way to record because you can only record like 2 minutes of audio onto each cylinder. But and he was dead set, just like, nope, this is the greatest invention. It's like nothing could ever improve on this whatsoever. And he also ran into the other problem, and that was he picked all of the music that his company recorded.
Yeah, so you have like Mary Had a Little Lamb, Ba Ba Black Sheep, and the Itsy Bitsy Spider.
So he picked all of the songs, and when other music started to become more popular, he refused to change it, stating that, no, these people need to know what good music is, and that's the music I like. And that's how the company failed. That and the creation of Shellac Records, which were actual discs, which then got turned into vinyl.
It never ends well for literally anyone who thinks they have better taste in music than someone else.
Yep, especially when the generation changes.
Mm-hmm.
So, but for a while, Edison dominated everything. Everything, because he was the only one who could.
Yeah. And then, of course, he patents it. And so, like, you know, nobody even was allowed to.
Yes. But if you want, you can still buy phonograph players, which still will run wax cylinders. You can buy blank cylinders and actually record your own stuff onto wax cylinders. And so I'm waiting for like that one really, really trendy hipster band to like actually release an album on a giant box of wax scrolls.
Exclusively on wax.
Yeah, it's not going to happen because we all know that reel to reel is the new vinyl. So
that is true. That is true.
We should bring back 8-tracks.
We should bring back 8-tracks.
No,
8-tracks were
terrible quality.
What are you talking about? It was great quality.
Not
way better than cassette.
Terrible quality. Well, I mean, compared to cassette.
True.
What was the precursor to vinyl?
Shellac.
Shellac?
Yeah. So they made like hard shellac because, you know, shellac will dry and harden. But it was better than the wax cylinders because, like I said, the wax cylinders could easily be, warped and or melt. Not to mention making duplicates of wax cylinders was exceptionally hard. So what they did was when they made the first shellac records, they had them, you know, spread out just like a normal record, except it played at twice the speed that a normal record was. But it was had a lower quality than what we would consider for vinyl records, but it was still a really good medium in between. So it's good that we made that step from shellac to vinyl, but you know, it took a while.
Yeah.
But I've heard a couple of shellac records and they sound okay. They sound better than wax cylinders. But yeah, compared to vinyl records, they just don't sound the same.
Well, the big thing was the diode.
Yeah,
that allowed the dual polarity mm-hmm. to replicate what a diaphragm was doing on a Victrola.
Yes.
So it was electric amplification that was really the big breakthrough in audio quality.
Also, if you didn't know this, shellac records will break almost instantly if you touch them, bump them, or anything. But vinyl records, they're semi-flexible, and so you could drop a record and it wouldn't break.
You could throw it like a frisbee and it wouldn't break.
You could toss it and it wouldn't shatter.
Well,
vinyl
will.
Shellac records were like three times as thick as
they sound like
a vinyl record.
They sound like clay pigeons. You
know? That's almost what they are, like, except wider and thinner.
Huh.
But yeah, they were super heavy and like super dense and they played at twice the speed of a vinyl record, which means you had to have a more powerful motor for all that kind of stuff, or you just had to have the crank that would actually like get it going
and a steady hand to crank it.
Yeah, it had a lot of limitations, and then later on it just developed into better technology. But that was back when everybody was thinking in like all those analog terms, which is why then we got 8-track and cassette, And then we switched over to digital with CDs and then MP3s and WAV files and, you know, like the iTunes AAC format and that kind of stuff.
I don't know if our next artist has any shellac recordings, but if we move on, in 1958, Carl Perkins leaves Sun Records to sign with the Columbia label as their first rockabilly artist. The second, anyone?
I know who it is, so.
He's the man in black.
He is.
I'm Johnny Cash. The same year, as a matter of fact. So there you go. Carl Perkins, first rockabilly artist on Columbia.
Yeah, Sun Records really had some bad luck there with losing Carl Perkins and Johnny Cash the same year. And when did, Elvis left Sun Records shortly after that, didn't he?
Elvis's contract was sold.
Oh, same.
So they made money off of that deal, but I'm pretty sure that he probably did the same thing with Carl Perkins, you know, just because, I mean, that's really what Sun Records was. Sun Records was find artist, develop artist, sell to somebody else. That was their plan.
Profit.
Yep. That's all it was.
And that worked until they went bankrupt in 69.
Yes. That's because they ran out of artists that they could find.
Because anybody profitable, they sold.
Yeah, exactly. So that was the downfall of Sun Records.
They were left with the Lollipop Guild.
Yeah, whereas you look at somebody like Chess Records who kept artists for decades. They made money for a long time.
Yes, they did. And then eventually fell out because nobody was buying the other records.
Well, that's true.
So, yes, I get it. I mean, there's no magic formula for making a successful record label unless you're just going to keep finding the next artist.
Unless you're Suge Knight. And then that formula is, let's just say it involves violence.
Develop a drug cartel on the side to fund it.
Find artist, make them famous, murder them. Profit.
On a side note, have you guys seen the trailers for the new, like, from the people who did the People versus OJ? And they're doing now the unsolved crime of Biggie and Tupac?
Oh, no, I haven't seen that.
The guys who they got playing Biggie and Tupac are freaking spot on.
That's awesome. Is it the same?
Like, I swear to God, I was like, did Tupac actually reveal himself and is playing himself now? Like, that's what this dude looks like.
Now, are these the same actors that played Biggie and Tupac previously in other films?
Like, I'm not entirely sure. Like, I might have to actually look that up. Okay, but I mean, like, they are definitely spot on that.
Very cool.
Yeah. Well, I heard that, Jake. What are you opening up there? Can of beer? Okay.
Is that Four Loko?
Yes, I have the last Four Loko can in existence.
It expired 3 years ago, which actually makes it taste better.
Dates is just Big Brother telling you to buy something new.
I don't know why, but you just reminded me of one of those like YouTube videos where it's like, dude invents a time machine and he goes back in time and the only thing he does is get Crystal Pepsi.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Big Brother, that segues nicely into our next story.
Yes, that is true. Moving on to 1972, the BBC bans Paul McCartney's Give Ireland Back to the Irish, which, of course, they banned it because the BBC doesn't want Ireland to be a unified country because they suck.
Yeah. It's such a noble concept. Give Ireland back to the Irish.
A nation once again. Sorry, that's anybody who's seen Hard Day's Night know that Paul's grandfather starts singing that whenever he's around the cops because they want a unified Ireland. I'm not even sure that the Irish really care. Like, I mean, I've seen a bunch of stuff about the Irish people who, like, they don't really like Northern Ireland, or Northern Ireland, as they like to call it. It's just, I don't know, it's a weird situation.
Well, there's almost nothing Irish left in Northern Ireland anymore.
That's true.
To be honest.
Like, they don't talk the same. It's a weird situation. I mean, maybe there's a group of people that want to unify them, but for the most part, they're just like, whatever, you know. Let's just stay separate. That's how it is. Who knows? Either way, let's go ahead and get up to 1983, where Patty Austin and James Ingram do a duet together known as Baby Come to Me, hits number one in America. The song is written by Rod Temperton, who was the composer of Thriller. But of course, if you remember, we totally made fun of James Ingram last week. So we wanted to do a little bit more justice to him and play you a little clip of this Patty Austin, James Ingram, Baby Come to Me from 1983.
Spending every dime to keep you talking on the line. That's how it was. And all those walks together out in any kind of weather. Just because there's a brand new way of looking at your life when you know that love is standing by your side.
Baby, come to me. Every foot miles around you, it's what's meant to be. And I'm also glad I found you.
I'm so glad that I found you.
Now, I've heard that song a bunch of times. That one actually shows up in movies and stuff like that. So I honestly had no clue that that was him.
Yeah, that's a good song.
I feel bad for like just crapping all
we
over.
We shouldn't because Natural Man is still a terrible idea.
True.
Still a terrible concept.
True.
But I told you James Ingram had a big career in his back pocket.
Yes.
That a lot of people don't know about.
So there you go. There you go.
There you go.
Well, I like it.
Ready for some birthdays?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's do it.
Happy birthday to this guy. The year was 1948. The band was Black Sabbath. The guitarist, Tony Iommi, is born in Birmingham, England.
Birmingham.
Yeah. no, Tony Iommi, great guitar player, iconic guitar player in an iconic band.
I mean, I'm not even entirely sure there's much more that needs to be said. It's like, if you don't know who Tony Iommi is, then you don't listen to great rock music.
Or you haven't heard our review of Black Sabbath's
album? What?
Headless Cross.
That's right. Yes, Headless Cross.
It took me a second.
Took me a second too. You know I'm horrible with names, so
yeah.
That's why.
But if you want a brief history of Tony Iommi and Black Sabbath themselves, go check out that little known fact, right? That I didn't know until I did notes for this show. Tony Iommi was in Jethro Tull for like 2 weeks. So before Black Sabbath started, and they picked up Ozzy when they were still, it was Geezer Butler and Bill Ward playing with Tony Iommi as a band called Earth. They split up for a little while, and Tony Iommi joined Jethro Tull for about 2 weeks and played like 3 shows with him.
Are you sure it wasn't Candy Colored Rain?
I'm pretty sure it wasn't Candy Colored Rain.
Or what, was it Jim... like Jim Henderson's Bag of Nails or something like
that. Something like that. Yeah, but no, they were Jethro Tull by then. It was 68.
They had figured it out at that point.
Yeah, okay. And there's video footage of that you can see Tony Iommi playing with Jethro Tull and Ian Anderson.
Wow. Well, speaking of great names, huh?
Yes, 1963, born on this day, is a man known as Seal. He has a lot more names, and it goes something along the lines of Seal, Henry, Olesugan, Samuel. Yeah, I nailed that.
Ooh, can I try?
Yeah, if you want to give it a shot, go ahead.
How about this? Seal, Henry, Olesugan, Olamide, Adiola, Samuel?
Yeah, sure. He was born in Paddington.
That's Olesugan. All right, that's Olesugun Olamide Adiola. All right, I'm done. I can't. Look, I'm
Either
sorry.
Either way, Seal was, of course, born in Paddington, England. Very British man. You may also remember him. He shows up in random movies and TV stuff, and he's the dude who's got, like, the scars on his face, which I believe he got from an car accident earlier on in his life. But he is very well known for his voice, with that sort of smooth, kind of gravelly, also
da da
like,
da 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 da.
Yes. There used to be a graying tower alone on the sea.
Wow, you actually know the real
words. Yeah. How could you not?
I mean, I know.
You became
it's the same thing as Eye of the Tiger.
Light on the dark side of me. And now remains the jug that's the high and not the pill. But did you know that when it snows, my eyes become alive? Yeah.
Yeah. Baby, I compare you to a kiss from a rose.
Not my favorite Seal song, though, but it was definitely the most famous Seal song. That is a good album either way. It's got a lot of great hits on there. But there is a song that he does called I Have Been Waiting. It's my favorite Seal song, and it's just, I still love it to this day.
Wow.
Yeah, great song.
I've always been partial to Crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's me.
Yeah. But if you get a chance, check out more of Seal's stuff. Obviously, he's got a wide catalog of songs that you can check out. But for my pick, I'm definitely going with I Have Been Waiting. That's one of my favorites. So
our first day was a solid one.
Yeah, that was pretty good. I know it was a little bit longer, but
I wonder what February 20th has in store for us.
Kick it.
Okay, because this one's going to knock your socks off. 1969, the Christian Marquardt-directed film titled Candy, based on a book of the same name written by Terry Southern, debuts in London with the dreaded X rating.
Ooh.
The screenplay was adapted by Buck Henry, the same guy who wrote The Graduate,
yep,
and stars Marlon Brando, Richard Burton, James Coburn, Walter Matthau, and Ringo Starr.
Wow, what a
Richard
lineup.
Richard Burton.
Walter Matthau.
Yeah, 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 yeah. You wouldn't think, well, let's just dig a little deeper, shall
we? Okay, all right.
The film is a lampoon of the porno craze that rocked the U.S. East Coast in the late 60s. However, I think Roger Ebert may have described the film best in his 1968 review when he says, "The plot is fairly simple. Candy carooms from one man to another like a nympho in a pinball machine, and the characters she encounters are improbable enough to establish Terry Southern's boredom with the conventions of pornography." He also comments that there's something wacky about using restraint in a satire of pornography.
Hmm. You know, it's interesting. So they have, speaking of Lampoon, mm-hmm, they have, you know, National Lampoon, which was kind of in the business of being raunchy as well. There's a new documentary. Well, not really a documentary, but on Netflix.
Yes.
Have you guys seen it?
There's a documentary and a movie.
Yeah. Well, the movie I've been watching is...
it's the greatest film ever made.
Isn't it A Stupid and Futile Gesture?
Yes. Futile and Stupid Gesture.
Oh, gesture. Okay.
That's the movie that is based on the book, which is the same title. But there is a documentary also about National Lampoon called... it's like Young, Drunk, Stoned, and Dead or something like that. And it's from the reference of Animal House when he's like, you know, young, drunk, and stoned is no way to go through life.
Well,
something like that.
I'm just really fascinated right now with that time period where this kind of raunchiness was not necessarily mainstream, but kind of. I mean, it was kind of like
really
side
was.
Stream.
Okay,
yeah.
So Terry Southern is an author with a lot of cred. He did almost all the dialogue for Dr. Strangelove. Which is an epic masterpiece of satire. However, in the 60s, like, porno chic was the mainstream. Who was it? The New Yorker took pictures of Jackie Kennedy going in to a theater in New York. it was pretty crazy. And the film Candy, I saw some clips of it on YouTube, and it had an R rating in the U.S., for whatever reason, if you make sex funny in the UK in the 60s, the powers that be didn't like that. Apparently, it wasn't a laughing matter.
Well,
it wasn't. It was very not British.
Yeah, I mean, they don't have a very good sense of humor to begin with.
But the character
Coitus
Candy
is not funny.
The character Strictly Candy is simultaneously an alien and a high schooler.
Okay,
and all these characters are people that she encounters. So if you ever want to see what Walter Matthau would look like as a sex icon, go rent Candy.
Yeah, see, that's kind of why I was a little surprised.
Yeah, he's a general.
Oh, Walter.
Going from one movie to another, we have in the year 2000.
In the year 2000.
A biographical TV movie, Little Richard, airs on NBC with actor Leon in the title role. I have not seen this movie, and I don't really care to, but I just want to point out the more important fact is that Leon was in the movie Cool Runnings about the Jamaican bobsled team.
Some people say, you know, they can't believe
Jamaica, we have a bobsled team. So, do you remember the names of the characters?
We have
Tyrese Bannock. Tyrese Bannock.
I just remember Sanka.
Sanka.
You dead man?
Junior. And Yul Brynner.
That's right.
Did the egg have a name?
Did you say the
egg?
No,
it was just his lucky egg.
That's his lucky egg, yeah.
I couldn't remember.
Sanka, you dead man? Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Sorry. I'm really big into the Winter Olympics. I hate sports in general, but I love the Olympics, and I love the Winter Olympics especially.
And surprisingly, I've totally been loving NASCAR. Brian loves NASCAR.
I don't love NASCAR.
Don't let him fool you. He's ashamed of it.
I can't
runs
name
in
like
his
a
blood.
Few of the drivers.
He can't
right
help
now.
It.
That's not true.
NASCAR
that's
on
not
ice?
True.
So it's not true. I honestly don't know anything about NASCAR. Jessica actually knows more about NASCAR
than
I do.
Look, he's getting all defensive. He can't just take a joke.
I know, right?
Aww.
But the Winter Olympics, we have, you know, this great thing that is happening right now as we record this even. So, go America.
Wait, we can't move on until you tell me which character Leon was, because I don't know.
Tyrese Bannock.
Okay, good. See?
His father could run 100 meters in 10 flat, and he ran it in 9.9. As John Candy said, sprinters make the best bobsledders.
I was in a bar watching.
Not a true statement, but still.
But still.
But actually, yes. In the women's bobsled team, there is a 4-man women's bobsled team from Nigeria. I'm not kidding.
Yes.
Like, from Nigeria competing, they are all sprinters, and they were training in Texas, actually, for the bobsled event. And everybody was like, that's awesome. It's like, and so everybody keeps joking that there needs to be another, like, Cool Runnings, except it be the Nigerian women's team.
Yeah.
And I was like, I am all for this movie.
Yeah.
This isn't like the women Ghostbusters or any of that. No. This would be a really good movie, in my opinion.
Yeah, in reality, I mean, it's kind of like the Ghostbusters remake. Like, it's 2018. If they were going to do anything close to a Cool Runnings remake, they should just do that.
Exactly.
Really? Honestly?
So, I hope you enjoyed our brief jaunt into Follow the Film with the actor Leon, who, of course, was in Cool Runnings. And apparently, he played Little Richard in a movie.
Very cool.
In the year 2000.
It was a decent biopic.
I have yet to see it. I will try and find it if I can.
Okay, well, this next one is kind of a cool one, but at the same time, it's kind of a bummer. So, 2009, a great band, The White Stripes, favorites of the host, Conan O'Brien, and his late night show, Late Night with Conan O'Brien. They came on the show and they played their song, We're Gonna Be Friends, and this was the final episode of Late Night with Conan O'Brien. Ends up being the last performance by the group because they split up 2 years later. And here's the song, We're Gonna Be Friends.
Fall is here, hear the yell, back to school, ring the bell, brand new shoes, walking blues, climb the fence, books and pens. I can tell that we are gonna be friends. Ground and look at all the books.
bugs we found safely walked to school without a sound. Safely walked to school without a sound.
So the White Stripes, one of the best two-person bobsled teams.
Yeah.
No, so
it's actually the two-person luge.
So the because you don't have two-person skeleton, I know that much. Which right. That'd just be crazy.
Because you'd go head first into somebody's butt. That's why.
So yeah, the White Stripes. Now here's the funniest thing about this. I actually didn't know this song was by them.
Well, you know,
I knew it from Napoleon Dynamite.
Yeah,
but and I always thought it was a nice little song that they played, you know, at the beginning of the movie, but. Yeah, I honestly had no idea that it was a White Stripes song. I guess because I'm so used to like the really driving chords and, you know, drum beats and stuff like that.
Just electric.
Yeah, yeah, electric in general. Yeah. So yeah, this was a surprise for me. And I was glad I actually found out that this was the White Stripes.
I think this song was the first time I was really introduced to Jack White being such a multi-talented musician. I mean, you know, he's known for playing the guitar, but... His diversity with his musical taste, because like you said, I mean, you think White Stripes and you think like Fell in Love with a Girl,
yeah,
or something, just really hard, yeah. Gritty.
I bet if you took just people who knew who both Matthew Sweet and Jack White were and gave them a Facebook poll.
That's got to be a small group of people. I'm going to let you know
enough.
That one.
But I bet if you did a Facebook poll of everyone on Earth who knew who those two people were, you would probably end up with people guessing that it was Matthew Sweet. Because it Man, seems I, more I like a Matthew Sweet tune.
I referenced a Matthew Sweet song in my office, and everyone stared at me blankly. And I was like, really? It's like, you guys don't know about Matthew Sweet? I'm like, no. Like, oh my God.
You're all white guys between the ages of 30 and 42 in the Midwest. How do you not know?
Like, Jesus.
If this is not the demographic, what is?
Here was the question I brought up before we started the show, too.
Go for it.
Final performance from the White Stripes is an acoustic performance with Jack White playing acoustic guitar and singing.
And saying, I can tell we are going to be friends.
Yeah, what was Meg White doing? Was she like?
I don't.
Was she like tapping her foot?
She might have been. Maybe. I mean, because there's a little bit of like kind of percussion esque stuff in the background that could be like tapping on your leg or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, but there's no actual like drum beat or anything there.
Like she's in the background, like doing the like sign language interpretation.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's a joke.
So. Let's get up to 1946 for our first birthday of the day, and that is John Giles.
Yeah.
What?
Born in 1946 on February 20th. Of course, he is the founder of the J. Giles Band.
Yeah.
But he was born in New York City, but grows up in Far Hills, New Jersey, which is just a hop, skip, and a jump from there.
J. Giles Band is one of those bands that, like, they're really good, but I feel like a lot of people... They're not like they weren't big enough for everybody to be like, oh my gosh, the J. Giles Band. But yet they had enough hits that they were really great. Because I want to ask you guys, like, what's your favorite J. Giles song?
Man, they're such a weird band for me because their name is almost a punchline in my head. Because like you're saying, I've never run into someone who's like the biggest J. Giles fan on earth.
Maybe I'm the biggest J. Giles fan that you know. And I'm not like a huge fan, but I do like them. Because Freeze Frame was like a perfect epitome of like the 80s in a way. Freeze Frame! Freeze Frame! But yet they also had like Love Stinks.
Yeah.
You know? And
let's see. I'm looking at a list of their hits. They had a cover of the song Looking for Love.
Well, their best song was
Give It to
Centerfold.
Me. Yeah, Must Have Got Lost.
Yeah,
Love Stinks,
that's a good one.
Freeze Frame and Centerfold.
Yeah.
Love Stinks was probably what was in my head.
Yeah,
Love
for me.
Stinks.
Because it's definitely the most like hard-hitting song of the bunch. And on top of that, it was used to great comedic effect in The Wedding Singer.
Yeah, it lends itself very well to that scene.
It's like, you know, it's like the one song that you know you can play, like, if someone breaks up and you're just like, yeah, this sucks.
He loves her, and she loves him. And he loves somebody else. You just can't win. It's so, like, pissed off.
Yes, exactly. I like that. So, well, yeah, there you go. Love Stinks. That's my pick for Jay Giles.
Great, great. Well, we got, these are both great birthdays today, because Jay Giles, and then our next one, born on this day in 1967 in Aberdeen, Washington, none other than the legend that is Kurt Cobain.
Yes. As we all know, Kurt Cobain was a strapping young lad in the Seattle area who went on to basically change the course of music as we know it.
America's favorite junkie.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, of course, he was in that one band that nobody can remember their name. I think it was Nerve something, Nirvana, maybe. And, yeah, we could spend an entire episode just going through Kurt Cobain's catalog.
We should maybe start introducing, like biography episodes.
Yeah.
That would be kind of cool.
We should definitely do some of that. Let's make a list after the show, and we'll come up with some good ones.
Jay Giles, Kurt Cobain.
Yeah. So, you know, of course, tragically, Kurt Cobain was taken from us very early.
Yeah.
And he took himself.
Yes.
Out of the picture, but he has had a lasting effect on the music world and the music industry, and it's still going strong to this day.
And the fashion industry.
Yeah.
I mean, really, though.
I mean, you go to Portland, and it's like everybody still dresses like that.
People wanted...
Because the dream of the 90s is alive in Portland.
People wanted to be Kurt Cobain. You know, he was one of those people that he was emulated.
I love it when they talk about the fashion sense of the grunge movement. And that is, hey guys, it's like, we're going to be punk, but we're not going to be too punk. We're going to wear cardigans. And if you actually like look at it, there's a lot of things of Kurt Cobain wearing sweaters.
And you know, the truth is, it's really more about just not caring.
Yes.
You know?
And actually for them, it was a bit more utilitarian. It was like, hey, it's cold in Seattle. We're going to wear sweaters.
Which is why they started a band.
Exactly.
It was because they were bored because it was always rainy and kind of overcast, and
yeah,
so why don't we just chill in the garage and play some music and
smoke
some cigarettes and wear our flannel. Cool stuff. Well, so, happy birthday, Kurt.
Let's get to the next day, though.
Mm-hmm.
Of February 21st.
You're gonna love this.
Hopefully. I haven't read this one, so I don't know what we're doing.
No, you don't. 1958, on this day, Gibson introduces its Flying V guitar on the market.
Nice.
Yeah. Retailed for $247.50.
Oh my gosh! I wish they were still that cheap.
You could still get a decent guitar for $250.
Oh yeah, you certainly could,
for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But a 58 Gibson Flying V commands much more than that.
But yeah, I was gonna say a 58 American-made Gibson Flying V—that's like at least a grand.
Well, anyway, the early adopters of the Flying V include Lonnie Mack and Albert King. But what you may not know, blues guys. What you may not know is it was not intended as a replacement for the Gibson Les Paul. It wasn't supposed to be a blues man instrument. Its intended market at first was for pedaled steel and dobro players.
So, like a lap guitar.
Yeah. Originally, it was being designed with the flat non-radius neck, the pickups all the way up to the last fret. It was an electric replacement for the dobro was the idea. However, nobody wanted that. So they transitioned and they decided, hey, maybe we can give this to the country guys who need something a little bit louder. And, you know, they like to play that chicken picking thing really high up on the neck. However, the Flying V, get it? Flying V, if you're holding it horizontally, Flying V. If you play it like a chicken picker does, way up on your chest, you know, like up by, you know, where your bow tie is, it's the most uncomfortable guitar in the world to try and play like that. So, again, nobody bought it. So, 1958, they only made, I think, 100 of them, and then didn't bring it back for another 10 years. And when they did, they completely redesigned it, and it had a radius neck and all the accoutrements and the what's the word I'm looking for? They standardized it to what people were going to play with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really interesting, too, because I never would have guessed anything about, like, the blues style, because for me, the Flying V has always been, like, the epitome of rock and roll. You know, I think of people like ZZ Top when I think of the Flying V, you know, like, which I guess kind of has some blues influence because they're a southern rock band.
Yeah.
So I guess I can see that connection, but...
I'm trying to remember who it was. I remember an interview with a really early country guitarist, and I don't remember who it was, but he played a prototype, and the string through body of the guitar didn't even have the self-adjusting bridge that Gibsons have on them. It was just strung straight through into the back. And he was saying when he was sitting in Leo Fender's shop playing this thing that it tore holes in his shirt because it was just, it's supposed to sit horizontally. It wasn't supposed to sit on your chest. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, there you go. The Flying V did not take off like anyone thought it would and took a long time to get where it was.
Well,
I also wanted to point out that I did a little research into how much it actually would cost in today's money. There's another reason why it might not have taken off.
Yeah.
Because for $247.50 translates to $2,148.40 in 2018 as of this week.
Sounds about right. If you go into...
I ain't paying no $2,000 for a guitar.
That's about what a Gibson goes for these days.
That's what I'm saying. If you go into a rock shop, you know, an American-made one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a new one. That wouldn't... I mean, a classic would probably be more
it just
like
gets
$5,000
more.
Or more. But it's interesting because my dad owns a pair of Flying Vs. And, you know, when you, a lot of times if you're just picking around, you like to have a seat while you play guitar. Because I enjoy standing, but typically you want to sit down. And it's just the most inconvenient guitar to rest on your leg because the body makes it slide down. And so now the styles have kind of like a rubber. Kind of like a rubber grooved pad on the other side so that when you rest it on your leg, at least it kind of helps keep it from slipping. Because otherwise it just like falls off your lap and onto the floor. And as we've established, a guitar that expensive, you don't want that to happen. So
Yeah, and really the only reason that they brought it back, even I think it was 69 was when they brought it back, was because at the time, the late 60s going into the 70s, volume was becoming a problem for the size of venues that people were trying to play at.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done stories on this before.
Like the Beatles playing at Shea Stadium.
Right.
Like nobody could hear anything.
Now, anyone who has played an archtop guitar before, those really quickly fell out of style because they just didn't have enough overdrive to run through 150 feet of cable to make it to the amp to then amplify for the stadium. So Gibson went back to what they already had tooling set up for, and they're like, hey, we've got this solid body thing over here that's shaped like a V. Let's make that. And there you go.
Here's my last joke on the Flying V, is that since it always falls off my lap when I play it, that's where the flying part comes in for me. Because it flies away from me. Okay. Well, this next one is awesome, mainly because it's a band I like, and they're doing something that's like really rock and roll. In 1977, at a concert stop at the Nassau Coliseum, every member of the rock band Kiss has some of their blood drawn. But it's not at the Red Cross. They weren't donating to hurricane relief victims here. The blood would be mixed with ink to be used to print the very first Kiss comic book, which appears in June. The process from bloodletting to print is notarized for authenticity. So in theory, it's better than an autograph. You could get this comic book made with part of Gene Simmons, with part of Paul Stanley, Ace Frehley, Peter Criss.
But with no guarantee that there's a single molecule of their actual blood in your comic book.
Because it could just be all ink.
And it could honestly, I mean, like, who knows how much they actually, like, drew out. I mean, it could have been, like, a syringe worth. And the amount of ink that they needed for the comic books could have been a massive amount.
I mean, it's a novelty.
There's video of it, and I think it's... Yeah, I want to say it's Gene Simmons dumping it into, like, a vat of red ink. And what he's holding in his hand... If you have ever pulled out like a vial of iodine from a first aid kit, Like, that dwarfs what he's pouring in this ink. Also, for those of you who are fans of homeopathy, you're probably familiar with Avogadro's constant, sometimes called Avogadro's number.
Yes.
And that is, there's a constant way. You can predict that there's zero chance that you'll find a single atom of their blood in your ink. But anyway.
It's still a cool concept, and it makes for a cool story. So. I like it. And I like Kiss.
Tons of free press from that event because that story was everywhere. And every preacher went home and told everybody about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway.
Well.
The knights in Satan's service.
That's right.
So, I like that, though. Still, it's a fascinating way to market yourself.
I wonder what I'd like to read the comic book, the actual story behind the comic.
It's got to be better than the movie.
Yeah, Kiss meets
the Phantom of the Park.
Yep.
Yeah. Buddy.
Well, it's time for more birthdays.
Yes. 1943 and February 21st, record executive David Geffen,
who
is, of course, the founder of Geffen Records and the film company DreamWorks.
Whoa.
He is born in Borough Park, Brooklyn.
Boy, talk about a gosh darn mogul.
Yes. So let's see here. I'm looking for the list of artists that he had. Had a bunch of them listed here when he first started. Artists, Mary J. Blige, The Roots, Blink 182, Rise Against, and Common. Let's see here. Current artists is everyone all over the place. Ellie Goulding, Griffin, Jeff Bosker, Lil Jon, Muramasa, Neon Trees. Oh, I like Neon Trees. Let's see. Rock City, Shawn Mendes, All American Rejects, Tori Kelly, Will Sparks, and Ex-Ambassadors.
Wow. It's actually Ellie Goulding, but it's spelled Goulding. I get it. She did that song, Lights.
I love her. I think she's a sweetheart. I really like her music.
I saw her at the pageant.
Oh, yeah?
She's actually, interesting because she's a really great singer, but what really surprised me about her was how soft-spoken she is. Because her songs are good, and they're pop songs, but, like, she would finish a song, and then she'd be like, thank you so much, everybody. Like, I really appreciate you coming out here.
I so narrowly missed going to that concert. I really wanted to make it, but...
I think that was one of those where, like, I had gotten some free tickets through the radio station or something.
Okay.
And I took my girlfriend at the time. But it was a good show. She put on a good performance. But, yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, these are all really contemporary artists, you know? And not only that, but how did he get into the whole DreamWorks thing, too?
He just did.
I guess when you have money, you can just do... cool stuff, right?
And if you ever get a chance to go back and look at, like, their past artist list, it is impressive.
There's a really good interview. I think it was for MTV, and I think it was Matt Lauer. He interviewed Kurt Cobain, and Kurt told him the story about David Geffen was trying to sign Nirvana when Heart-Shaped Box came out. He was trying to re-sign them to, like, a multi-label deal. And Kurt told him to meet him at this like Sotheby's auction or whatever. And he tried to convince him on the spot to buy him Lead Belly's guitar because it was up for auction.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Trying to strong arm him into doing it and dangling like four new Nirvana albums over his head.
Yeah. Hey, it's like, hey, meet me at a Guitar Center.
Yeah.
Be like, and then you get there and just be like, I want that.
Yeah.
That's cool. Very cool.
So, next birthday.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I got this one, too, because I've been a fan of hers for a while now. She was born in 1986 in a little-known place called Cardiff, Wales. And actually, every Doctor Who fan on Earth should know Cardiff, Wales, because that's where they filmed, and that's what everything looks like. So, for us, we have Vancouver. They have Cardiff, Wales. Just saying. So... Charlotte Church was born in Cardiff, and she got her start in singing at age 11 in 1997 on the Big Big Talent Show. Her first album, Voice of an Angel, was released in 1998 and established her as a classical soprano, and she sounded a little something like this. So there you go. That is Charlotte Church. She was a little bit older in this particular recording. This wasn't her at age 11 or 12. She was maybe like 13 or so at the time of this.
She is fantastically talented.
And that's exactly why the album was recorded, Voice of an Angel. You know, a great collection of her singing operatic tunes, as well as some very classic traditional songs, some Irish, some Welsh, and some English stuff in there, and all very, very good stuff. So let's see here. In 2003, she was featured on trance music producer Jürgen Vries' single, the opera song, otherwise known as Brave New World. And it was quite well received. And later on, in 2005, she actually had her first crossover album called Tissues and Issues. And I'm going to play you a little sample of that one as well.
I like the sound of your bell dropping, your door locking, you jangle your key. Sound of your heart stopping, of lip locking, the grazing of knees. Yeah, I like the sound of skin touching, hands fumbling. You do as you please. I like the sound of back on the wall. Yeah, shelves falling. Oh yes, indeed. And I love it when you call my name. I love it when you call my name.
So that is the evolution of Charlotte Church, ranging from the classic opera soprano that she was as a child, and then going on up to doing her first crossover, Tissues and Issues. In 2006, she had her own show on Channel 4, the BBC 4, called The Charlotte Church Show. And she released another album that came out in around 2010, but around 2009, she decided that she wanted to kind of not do anything for a while, and she has since had a couple of kids, and has now finally actually gotten back into touring and singing. But I have not heard of a new album release from her since the 2010 release, and so it's probably about time that something dropped.
Ladies and gentlemen, do yourself a favor and do not watch those two videos back to back like we just did. Do not, because oh my goodness, that 2005 video is so hot. Holy cow!
What is it? Would that be like putting on the Mickey Mouse Club and then pulling out like Britney Spears' first release?
That first one was gorgeous. Like that first song was beautiful, and she is like a little angel. And that second one is like her as a little devil. And oh.
So you should follow that up with also the Mickey Mouse Club and then Miley Cyrus twerking on Robin Thicke at the and
I don't want to sound like too much of a creep here. I'm just saying that, like, she is smoking hot. Jeez.
The funny thing, and we had this discussion beforehand.
I'm sweating.
Is that, like,
I am sweating.
My favorite song that she ever did, though, is called My Leg in Love. And it's a traditional song, I believe, from Ireland. And it is a fascinating song that is just her singing and a harp. And that's it. And I like that song a lot. I used to listen to it, and it's like 2 minutes long. And I would listen to it, like, with my headphones on, like, as I was going to bed. And I just keep repeating it back over again because it's just got a gorgeous melody to it, and her voice is just sublime.
You know what they call a harp in Ireland?
No.
A harp.
Yep.
Okay. I mean,
that's a good old Jacob Crumb humor there.
Oh, right.
You know what they call a donkey in Ireland?
A donkey?
I don't know.
A burro?
An ass.
Up to February 22nd now, I think that we should kick this on over to Greg.
Well, the year was 1985. Carl Perkins plays a nightclub bouncer in the John Landis directed film Into the Night. It is Perkins' only film role as an actor. Now, Carl Perkins, great guitar player, most notable for the song Blue Suede Shoes. Hey, you know that one.
That is true, because Elvis stole it and turned it into his song, and that's the one that everybody frickin' remembers, except for the old-timers who actually know.
Mm-hmm.
And Carl Perkins is the man.
Okay, which one's the better version, fellas?
Man, I'm going to have to go with Carl Perkins. I have to, because I appreciate his brother's guitar playing on the original recording, the 1954 recording.
Okay, good.
I just love the hell out of that album, to be honest.
Great.
Matchbox
I
Blues.
I think that Elvis's version was better produced. But Carl's version is definitely like the more country version of it. And in my opinion, it is the better song.
I think Perkins chews the scenery on his vocals better than Elvis does.
Yes. Now, Carl Perkins is one of those guys that, like, he may not have been as popular as Elvis or Johnny Cash or, you know, any of the other guys who were signed to Sun Records at the time.
Jerry Lee.
Yeah, Jerry Lee Lewis, that guy. But he is one of these guys that is very well respected by, like, everybody else. And that's because he was an exceptionally talented musician. He was a really good guitar player. And he just, he knew how to craft songs. You know, it's that simple.
So, bringing us back to this day in music history, what about his acting?
I've never seen this film. And if you ask me to name, if I started naming just things that John Landis was involved in, I've never heard it. The Night.
Into the Night. Yeah.
However, I mean, Carl Perkins was tall, so he had that going for him as a bouncer, you know?
Because I'm not familiar with the film either. He plays a nightclub bouncer, but, like, was that a bit part, or was that, like, the lead role? See, I don't know.
I think that's actually a valid question. That I came here and I thought we would not get into and we would just brush over. You decide to do a deep dive on, Greg.
That's because the people need to know.
So thanks for that.
Honestly, I mean, check the film out, you know? We're here.
I don't know where to find it.
We serve it up to you.
It could be public access. Well, 85.
Try your local neighborhood Blockbuster. Oh, okay. Well, let's send it on over to Brian Kroc.
Yes, that is true. It is for me. In 2008, after much controversy and debate over whether or not to honor recently deceased musician and Missouri native Ike Turner, the state legislature compromises and passes a resolution that honors his musical achievements only.
Yeah, I think, honestly, I think that was kind of a responsible decision there.
Yep.
It's kind of like...
Ike had his problems.
Yeah.
Ike definitely had his problems. He was not a good person.
And this kind of just fits the narrative of a lot of different musicians, too, where you have that debate. I mean, we've said the same thing about Chuck Berry even before, where it's
yes.
like, you know, I mean, you can't...
And I think that for a lot of us, though, in St. Louis, like, we just kind of overlooked his badness for the most part. We were just like, okay, you know, whatever. He still did all of this great stuff, though, and his music was amazing.
Well, it's like...
But Ike took it to a whole other level. I mean, he was, like, violent and, like, just...
I mean, he has songs about his violence.
Yes.
Written.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't, you know, like, catchy stuff. I mean, this is, like, he was not a nice person, but he still did a lot of stuff in the music world.
Well, it's the same concept even when... Like, for example, you know, the Volkswagen Bug was the brainchild of Hitler. Do we hate the Volkswagen Beetle? No. Do we like Hitler?
Volkswagen no. for the people.
Yeah, the people's car. That's right. So, I mean, it's kind of that same concept is that, you know, you might not like Hitler, but you can appreciate the Volkswagen Beetle. In
yes.
this case, Ike Turner, you know, kind of a douche. But also, he had some decent songs. Yeah, maybe we can just leave this one at that.
Go for it.
Okay. Well, let's move on to some birthdays then. And Mr. Jacob Crumb, this one's for you, buddy. In 1923, born on this day, Hurricane Smith, the well-known engineer and producer, is born Norman Smith in Edmonton, London, England. He served as an RAF glider pilot and tried to make it as a session artist. I believe jazz bass.
I suspect. I'm not sure. I couldn't get a definite on that.
Yeah. But nonetheless, the key word is tried to make it, which is kind of why it's ambiguous. In 1959, he began an apprenticeship with EMI as an engineer. He served as engineer on every Beatle record, for EMI that is, up to Rubber Soul, where he was promoted to producer. Then in 1967, he produced Pink Floyd's first album, The Piper at the Gates of Dawn, which it's kind of a weird album. But anyways, 1971 saw the release of Hurricane's first single, Don't Let It Die, which hit number 2 on the British charts. Can you guys tell that he produced a bunch of Beatles albums? Yeah.
He's actually got a really, like, interesting voice, in my opinion. Like, if you'd stuck him, I mean, I know this stuff was kind of fairly happy, and, like, I guess this was the stuff you really wanted to do, but if you stuck him in a rock band where he could actually, like, sing some stuff, I mean, he would have sounded amazing.
I'd like to hear him do this weird, cutesy kind of not quite big band sound. And redo some, like U.S. 60s protest songs.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, could you imagine him doing,
what? Jefferson?
No, solo guy with the guitar.
Yeah, that Dylan? Narrows it down. Dylan? Richie Havens? Country Joe.
I suck.
Shall I continue?
Barry Maguire.
Barry
Eve
Maguire.
Of Destruction.
Yes, Eve of Could Destruction.
Could you imagine him doing Eve of Destruction with this weird, like, it would be like Eve of Destruction done in the style of Suicide is Painless, but with that guy's voice?
Huh. Actually, that would be cool.
It would be.
That would be cool.
But I'm glad that a guy who wanted to make it as a session artist, who wanted to be a recording artist, actually got to do it.
Yeah. I liked that song we just played, too. That was, like, very unique. So the nickname, of course, Hurricane, because, you know, it's not his real name, obviously. It was actually a nickname that came from a reversal of a cheeky pet name that John Lennon used to use. Lennon was impressed by Smith's unflappable attitude in the studio and called him Normal.
Which is a terrible nickname.
Normal?
Yes.
Well, and I mean the opposite of normal, Hurricane. So, it's cute. That's cute.
And that closes out February 22nd. So, now it's on to February 23rd, the last day on our show.
Yes, but still a good one. So, in 1997, on February 23rd, just in case you wanted to know, if Maynard, from, of course, the band Tool, Perfect Circle, all those great bands. Have you ever questioned whether or not he's actually a badass or if it's just a facade? Well, you can answer that with a quick little Google search, and you might find a clip during a show at the London Astoria. Tool's lead singer, Maynard James Keenan, an army veteran and a Brazilian jiu-jitsu practitioner, floors a fan who comes on stage and keeps him there in a chokehold. Now, mind you, this was during a song, which he continues to sing while detaining the fan. Like I said, the video evidence is there on YouTube, and the song that he continued to sing is Push It. And how fitting is it that the song lyrics were the same thoughts that that man's esophagus were having while he sang those lyrics and choked him out on stage?
I'd also like to point out that in the recorded version, that song is 9 minutes, almost 10 minutes long, 9 minutes and 54 seconds on the recording, which means in real life, it's probably more like 15.
I was just going to say, the version where with the choke in question is 14 minutes and 26 seconds.
I knew it.
Partially because they keep playing as people cart him off the stage. The fan, not Maynard. Also, I want to say Maynard hits his cue mid chokehold.
You know, it would have been pretty funny if they were carting the guy off stage and Maynard like kept like choking him out like off
no,
the
dude,
stage.
it's so badass. Like this guy walks up to him. And it obviously, like, positioning himself, and they exchange words just briefly before Maynard gives him a hip throw, rolls into a rear naked, and then as he's choking the guy, hits his cue and keeps singing. It's the coolest thing I've ever seen.
What point in the song does that happen?
Right there. This is the exact same version.
Oh, that was the moment that we played?
Yeah, almost,
oh,
yeah.
Cool.
It's one of the verses.
Okay.
Like, it's...
Wow. One of you guys had some great forethought there. Gee, hey, way to go us. Cool. Well, this next one, I actually really enjoyed the album review for this one.
So, in this one, though, in the year 2000, as well. We've had a lot of 2000s this week. In the year 2000, Tom Waits released his the heavily Roots-influenced Mule Variations. And he didn't release it. I got confused. So the Mule Variations, it actually wins a Grammy on this day for Best Contemporary Folk Album, which is not exactly a folk album, but I'll give it at least it's kind of in that genre. And it's the only time Tom Waits was ever called contemporary.
Ha-ha. So if you want to know what that category means, is like contemporary in recording style?
Yeah, I guess so.
So without any auto-tune or any effects? Hmm.
I remember that, actually, because I remember that being like a big deal about like that category.
Yeah.
Because it was like, you know, everything was still dominated by auto-tune and like all that kind of stuff. And they're like, we should have a category for recording that didn't have any of that. And Tom Waits doesn't need auto-tune. In fact, it'd be weirdly hilarious if he actually produced an album that was auto-tuned.
Now I want to see him redo Cher's I Believe in Life After Love.
Yeah,
I'd like to see this once. I'd love to see Tom Waits do like one sort of like techno dance song.
Like a trap song.
Just one. That's it. That's all he's got to do. Tom, if you're listening, please do that.
Well, I mean, the year 2000, you think about like what was popular. You know, we had boy bands were like huge. We also had like pop punk was huge. I know that was when Blink-182 was like the biggest thing. And then, you know, you have all these other pop artists like Christina Aguilera, Britney Spears, and then you have Tom Waits, who is kind of like the opposite of everything, but yet he still wins a Grammy for being contemporary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love it. We've got one birthday to close out the show.
Yes, we do.
And we're going back a ways on this.
Very far.
Mm-hmm.
How many hundred years, Jake?
I'll let you do the math. Because 1685 was a really good year for Baroque composers.
That is true.
Which included...
Not Baroque composers.
Right. Baroque.
Baroque composers.
Which include Johann Sebastian Bach, one of my personal favorites, Domenico Scarlatti.
Yes.
But
Bach is actually like one of my all-time favorites because it's extremely complex music.
Yes, it is.
Yes. But...
But... Today, February 23rd, we are talking about the German-English Baroque composer George Frederick Handel. He is born in Haile Herzogtum Magdeburg Brandenburgian Hohenzollerns.
Yes.
It just rolls off the tongue.
Rolls right off the tongue.
Beautiful in the spring.
Might be the longest title for a location we've ever had on the show, and I went out into outer space before.
That is true.
So, thank you, Prussia. It is often said of Frederick's early life that his father, George, was devastated by his son's fascination with music. And it did occur, and that his father did everything he could to rid Frederick of his love of music. But that is most likely poetic license from later authors. By age 9, he had begun formal training in the Prussian fashion. After university, Handel established himself as an up-and-coming organist in his hometown of Halle, before moving to Hamburg to produce opera, and then later to Florence. Sometime near the year 1707, the papacy issued a very brief ban on opera, so Handel moved to Rome to compose music for the Holy Father himself. In 1710, he entered the employment of the man who would become George I, King of Great Britain and Ireland. Here is where Frederick finally made his mark, if you can believe that. No, like, yeah, hey, I was writing music for the Pope himself, but now my career really starts.
Yeah, exactly.
So in, but moving on, later in 1741, Handel finished his best known work. It's 53 movements in 3 parts, and it's called Messiah. Its first performance was in Dublin on the 13th of April, 1742. The piece is marked by Handel's signature, which is simplicity and versatility. The fashion of the day for composers was to just go B.I.G. big with arrangements that threatened to collapse the stage just by the sheer weight of the people required to play it. and written on instruments with mind-bogglingly deep bass registers. Handel's genius, however, was to compose in the exact opposite direction of his contemporaries. Just as he had done at the Vatican, he arranged his Messiah so that even the smallest chapel with a modest choir and an organ could perform it.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, he spent his later years downsizing all of his earlier works. It could be said that Handel is the Baroque composer for the working man.
I'll agree with that statement.
I like
that. Well, I would just say, because Bach was all about ostentatious, like, complexity in his music, and, like, usually really dark stuff, too. And you look at other people from the same era, it's like, you know, they've all got, like, their things. But a lot of Baroque stuff, to me, is very, like, over the top. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey, let's take a nice melody and let's just make it the craziest thing we possibly can. They were prog rock of their time. And Handel, he went in a completely different direction with all of his stuff. And I still remember the one thing that I remember from Handel's Messiah. And the only reason why I remember this is because I saw it at the St. Louis Symphony when they perform it. And they basically perform it every year around Christmas.
Yeah.
And that is, they say, whenever they do the Hallelujah chorus, everyone is supposed to stand up. And the reason why everyone is supposed to stand up is because when it was performed for the king, I want to say, of England, and he was going along, they all of a sudden started playing the Hallelujah chorus, and he stood up, which means that everyone else had to stand up at the same time. And it's just a tradition that has continued to this day.
Ooh.
And nobody knows why he stood up. He never explained it. There is one theory that maybe he had fallen asleep, and then all of a sudden the loud chorus of Hallelujah woke him up, and so he quickly shot up thinking, you know, that there was that. The one he thought might have been the national anthem, and so he stood up for that. And then there's a couple of other. Legitimate theories. But yes, he never said why he actually stood up. But it is a tradition that still continues to this day. So whenever they play Handel's Messiah, everyone stands up for the Hallelujah chorus.
It turns out that his butt fell asleep, and he was like, ooh,
it's like, I just got to stretch out for a second, guys.
Yeah. I do like the fact that he just, you know, I mean, with music throughout the decades, sometimes you have people who kind of capitalize on what's popular. I like the fact that he literally looked at what is going on and said, I want to try and work towards the opposite. And that's cool.
Yeah, that came from his experience writing in Rome. Was part of it could have been an attempt to subvert, to prove his own worth against what the papacy was declaring as evil in opera, right? You know, it might have been like, say, because the reason opera was banned was because it was just too decadent, right?
So this was kind of, it was almost like sinful, so, yeah, too sexy.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah, so part of it could have been Handel was saying like, all right, well, forget you, because I'll make something sexy as hell that only requires 8 voices, an organ, and 2 lutes.
Lutes are sexy.
Lutes are pretty damn sexy.
They actually are sexy. Like, when I think of a lute, I think of, like, the guy who's just playing it, like, for his maiden, you know?
Yeah.
Ooh, romantic.
If you want to see the sexiest thing that's ever been filmed, Leonard Cohen. Okay.
You've lost me.
I know I've lost you. No, Leonard Cohen has an Austin City Limits with this gigantic, fat Greek lute player that is just absolutely undressing the camera with his eyes while he plays this lute. It's amazing. You should go look it up.
Also, if you didn't know, Sting actually has an entire album of lute songs.
Really?
Yes. Very good.
You know, honestly,
And there's a version of him doing Streets of Gold playing the lute, and it's brilliant.
See, if anybody could do it, it would be Sting.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was one of his weird, like, I'm going to make an album of lute music. Why not?
Wow. You know, I'm going to shut up after it because our show is over, ladies and gentlemen.
Basically, yes.
But, oh, gosh. What was I going to say? My joke threw me off, and now
you're lost.
Now I'm lost. Yes, it's the fact that you know, throughout the decades, it's just like when you're the first to do something, and it just throws everybody through a loop. What I'm getting at here is that the Pope said it was like too sexy, and in modern times, you're like, what? Like the opera? You know, classical music? Like, anybody ever was like, oh, this is sinful and this is too, you know, too provocative and stuff. And, you know, nowadays we have, like, people half naked on TV, like, just singing, like, you know, do me, do me, do me, do me, do me, do me.
I don't know if you've ever actually looked at plot synopsis for operas. They're all, like, a love triangle. I mean, every single opera is a love triangle.
It is pretty scandalous, but it's just compared to nowadays, you know, it just seems so innocent. And I think, you know, we just think it's old and boring, too.
Basically, what you're telling me, though, is that Love Stinks by the Jay Giles Band would be modern opera.
Ooh. Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
No, I don't even try to pay attention to the plot of operas and whenever I do watch them. So,
did you know?
Unless it's in English, then I pay attention. But there aren't a whole ton of English operas out there.
Did you know that when you talk about the Norwegians, the Scandinavians known as the Vikings?
Yes.
They're synonymous with the horns.
Yeah, and that didn't actually exist.
And that was completely fabricated by the opera.
Yes.
And that the actual Vikings had nothing to do with that.
Nothing to do with that. Also, Viking is a job title.
Yeah.
So they didn't call themselves Vikings. They're not, unless they were actually Vikings, like, you know, the carpenters.
Okay, we're getting it. This is, so I told you earlier, all right, off mic, I mentioned that I spent 40 minutes trying to figure out where the hell Handel was born.
Yes.
Right? That's because, like, at this time, there was this, like, 30 years war in Prussia and things were changing names, and I was not an acceptable answer for me to say Germany.
Yeah.
Like I had to get it right. I had to figure out what the name was in German, and even then, like, colloquial German, the High German didn't exist in 1685, so I don't even really know how all of this was pronounced. Well, I have no clue.
Every time you got a new ruler, he changed the names of places and everything.
Well, there
too,
were,
you know,
alliances, and like the Kingdom of Prussia didn't exist till 17th. You know what? We are derailing this farther than we need to because the show is done.
The show is done.
It's over.
It's over. So, once again, this has been the This Week in Music History on Follow the Sound. I have been your host, Brian Kroc. If you want to help us out, go to our website, followthesoundpodcast.com, and click on the Amazon banner, or just go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Once again, lineupmedia.fm. Thanks, guys, for letting us do the show. You're awesome. And I would know that because I work for you. And on top of that, once again, find us on all of our social media platforms. We are on Facebook. You can email us, I believe, info@followthesoundpodcast.com if you want to give us any kind of statements or tell us we suck. Or you can just comment on the post on the page or whatever. But find us on Facebook at the Follow the Sound group, or you can find us on Twitter at @IFollowTheSound. It's just that simple. So, once again, I am your host, Brian Kroc. Along with me has been Greg Harvey.
And I can tell that we are going to be friends.
And Jacob Crum.
Thank you.
That was your weakest exit yet.
Dramatic pause.
Yeah.
Okay. Remember, folks, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.